Over the course of his career, Charlie Trotter created a style of food and designed a style of service that set him apart from even his most talented peers. In the 25 years that he owned and cooked at his Chicago restaurant, Charlie Trotter's, he received a steady stream of rave reviews and won some of the most prestigious awards in the culinary world. He died earlier this month at the age of 54, and as a tribute, we are playing my 2004 conversation with this great chef today as part of our Food Friday series. He was here to talk about Workin', More Kitchen Sessions with Charlie Trotter, a PBS series and cookbook in which he demonstrated his innovative cooking techniques and took us through his entire creative process. I began by asking him about the title. Is it Workin' with an apostrophe because you were inspired by Miles Davis and his famous Workin' album?
That's exactly it. And our first book that covered the Kitchen Sessions program was called The Kitchen Sessions, and I wanted to continue the themes and simply lifted the name from Miles' great album back from the 50s.
Well, you said, to me, searching for perfection isn't anywhere near as interesting as trying to find your own voice, and that definitely could be said of Miles Davis, who was not the most perfect trumpet player, but definitely came up with the most distinctive
maybe
voice
the most original
at the time.
Yeah. Well, in my early days, I was certainly consumed with this idea of pursuing perfection, and then I realized that was a little bit boring, and so ended up thinking maybe it's more interesting to try to gain a something that's original and something that is unique to the way I look at food and everything else.
But when people go to a really top-notch restaurant, a restaurant that charges as much as you do, don't they expect perfection?
Don't get me wrong. I haven't abandoned perfection, and we're still interested in everything from the service to the wine program to the ambiance to the sequencing of the courses that make up the menu to be as flawless as they can be, but I'm more interested in originality than anything.
Well, Miles Davis used to complain that people expected him to play pretty much the same thing he played on the record, and he played differently every night. We really want that from the great jazz musicians. You change a menu pretty much
every night.
Is this jazz-inspired as well, or is there something else going on?
It's utterly jazz-inspired. My father was a jazz trumpeter. I'm named after Charlie Parker.
That's why you're Charlie rather than Charles.
That's probably it. But, you know, the idea, Miles once said that I'll play it first and tell you what it is later. And we have no signature dishes. The menu changes every day. And it's more about being in the moment and emphasizing the idea of interchangeability of foodstuffs.
Mm-hmm. Well, but a lot of chefs like to adjust their menus according to what they found in the market.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also faced with the problem that customers come back and say, I came here because the last time I ate the most wonderful whatever it was, and I wanted to have it again, and it's not on the menu.
In our very early days, we dealt with that, and we began to establish this precedent that you won't necessarily come back and find something that you had a month ago. Things change, things evolve, and I guess we try to model ourselves after the great Freddy Girardet from Crissier, Switzerland, who kind of cooked in the same way.
And you have honored him on your first show this year.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of a number of restaurateurs who have been called the world's greatest living chef. Is he better to you than, I know I'm putting you on the spot here, Alain Ducasse or Joël Robuchon or Paul Bocuse or some of the others who've received that accolade?
Well, each of those legends represents something different in the pantheon of a food restaurant world. I believe that even Mr. Ducasse, who's a great friend, and Mr. Robuchon, who's a friend, would acknowledge the significance of Freddy Girardet. I think both at one point, Robuchon and Girardet were calling each other the best chefs in the world. Mr. Bocuse occupies a completely other territory, and he's another world's greatest chef.
He's also invented a contest that the people in Japan obviously stole from. Their Iron Chef thing is based on his. He has 21 chefs from around the world come in and compete for the best chef of the year.
Well, the Bocuse d'Or, and actually 2 years ago, it's held every other year. The next one's coming up in the early winter of 2005, but in 2003, I was the judge from the United States, and so it's participants from each of 21 or 24 countries with a judge from each of those countries, and it's quite an extravagant production. But I think you're right. The Iron Chef was lifted a little bit from this, but
In that case, you're never sure whether does the food look beautiful or does it taste good.
You grade it on all merits, and there are presentations for big platters, presentations for individual plates, and then, you're eating everything.
Well, if you're changing everything every day, how can you maintain those standards of flavor? some things just aren't going to work as well as others.
I'm not saying that we are reinventing everything every day. It's not a brand new menu of wildly different dishes. It's more of an evolution of things. So one day the rabbit dish with chanterelle mushrooms and fava beans and tarragon and little pieces of sunchoke. Next day, maybe the chanterelle mushrooms are not available and a different mushroom is used. And then there's this sort of steady progression of flavors.
I hear that you have a Winston Churchill quote framed on the staff dining room in your restaurant, which reads, "To improve is to change. To be perfect is to change often."
Yeah, we have a number of quotes.
I didn't know Winston Churchill was a jazz fan.
Well, you know, maybe somehow he was. But no, the idea that, you know, there's an adage in the business world, which is, if it ain't broke, break it. And a lot of people are scared by that proposition, and I kind of borrow that as well. And you can't just stay stagnant. You've got to keep on pushing the envelope.
Well, you also take us all over the place in this show, searching for ingredients. So are you inspired by the ingredients, or do you look for certain ingredients that you're curious about?
The ingredients are everything. As a cook, you can be proficient, and you can hone your palate, but ingredients are 88% of cooking. Mm-hmm. And what we can do as cooks is to put them together in a pleasing way and pay respect to the basic flavors.
Later we'll have Neil Jordan here, who makes films and also writes books. Almost every filmmaker and theater director has told me that casting is 80% of the success of what they do. So it really is ingredients. It isn't what you do with them. I've seen people mangle some of the most beautiful pieces of meat you could imagine.
Well, certainly there's a wild enthusiasm on the part of a number of young chefs where their intentions are good, but perhaps they've gone down the wrong road in a way. But
And that's being encouraged today, isn't it? Are some people who are really thinking the wilder the better.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think for cuisine to be truly profound at the highest levels, it's not unlike great music. It needs to be able to impress and please both the expert and the uninitiated alike. So I think of my own mother, who's not. Doesn't know much about food, and if she's pleased, she knows what she likes. At the same time, at the very next table, maybe there's somebody who is from New York City, and they dine out every single night, and they know everybody, and they're good friends with Danielle Ballou and Jean-Georges Van Gerichten and everyone, and they know every nuance. And if the same dishes that are served to those two tables, people like my mother or friends of hers that like it, but they don't really know what's going on, and an expert is over here, that's when when they're both pleased with what's happening, that's when you're at the highest level, I think.
Have you been working at a slight disadvantage being located in Chicago, not in New York or Los Angeles? One of the big, I know you're opening a restaurant
right, well,
here.
Well, we all know that Los Angeles is an extravagant culinary wasteland, so I'm willing to entertain
San Francisco,
Valley. I'm willing to entertain the question of Chicago versus New York. No, why would I be at a disadvantage? I think that, you know, I mean, it's a city with kind of the metropolitan area of 9 million people and a lot of business traffic, and over 50% of our clients are from outside the Chicago metro area anyway, and we see people from around the world. I think when you look at the select group of the top restaurants in the world, and there really aren't more than 30 of them, I think, we all kind of share the same client base, and people are out. Half the customers that are coming to my restaurant tonight will say, well, we were just at Ducasse. We were just at the Fat Duck. We were just at
the French Laundry, perhaps.
The French, well, often. But, you know, they're dropping these references because they want to show their bona fides. They want to let you know that they know something, and that's great, and we look forward to that.
Well, so. Why do they have to impress you? It should only be you impressing them.
Well, I think they want to send the message to the kitchen through the service staff that, listen, we know what's up. We're from New York, you know. We eat at Danielle twice a week, you know. We have John George's cell phone.
You better be good tonight.
We know David Boulay personally. I mean, they want to let you know this stuff, and that's great, and we're happy to know it.
We've been talking mostly about French chefs or chefs that have been inspired by French cooking.
Mm-hmm.
You borrow from many different ethnic cuisines, but is it fair to say that what you do grows out of French cuisine?
It's fair to say that what I do grows out of French cuisine only insofar that our cuisine is extremely wine-friendly. And to me, the most profound food and wine pairings that have happened based on the paradigm of cuisine from Western Europe, where the great wines have been produced for the last 200 years. So that is really our chief acknowledgement to the French cuisine, that we want food that is very food and wine friendly, and that there are time-honored combinations of things that go together with the great wines from around the world. But now the great wines from around the world are being produced elsewhere from Western Europe. So we also, there's an Asian minimalist aesthetic that's woven into what we do.
And that means you don't have to use as much butter or cream as you might have in the past?
That means we use virtually no cream or butter. That means it's a very, very much of a vegetable-driven cuisine. We've been serving a vegetable degustation menu for 17 and a half years. Aside from that, all of the non-vegetable dishes are vegetable-driven preparations.
As they are in other parts of the world, but generally not in America. They say you can always tell whether a chef has worked in the United States by the amount of meat in the dish in relation to the amount of vegetables.
Yeah.
But you've been serving the vegetable, the multi-course dinner pretty much since you opened?
6 months after we opened, we converted completely to degustation-only format, so...
What led you to do that? I know a lot of people are disappointed when they go into a restaurant and they find they can't get a real vegetarian meal.
Well, I guess this is sort of Miles-esque, this response, but it's not so much being concerned with what the guest wants. It's saying, this is what I love, and I love it so much, I want to serve it forth to you. And so all we can do is serve a style of eating that we're excited about.
And you're serving 6 to 8 different courses of vegetables a night?
The vegetable degustation menu that's been in place for 17-plus years is a 9-course vegetable tasting, or if one wants more, it can go up to 15 courses. There's a grand tasting menu. There's a red wine menu. There's a sort of a extended kitchen table menu, which is up to 20 courses. So
that's an awful lot of different vegetable dishes, and each one of them requiring a different kind of flavor.
Yes.
Most vegetarians I know have complained that flavor has often had to be sacrificed for their ethical concerns. How do you find that much variety in flavor?
Oh, the most interesting part of cooking involves vegetables, texture-wise, flavor-wise, and you've got a palette of literally, you've got 150 different vegetables in season, 4 seasons of the year, more in the summer. And that's what's most interesting. I mean, fish and meat are sort of unidimensional in their texture and their flavor, but vegetables are the things that, in a sense, give color to the plate. And I don't just mean visually. I mean on the palate.
So then why is meat the basis of so many meals? Are people just eating meat out of habit?
Well, it's certainly not the basis of things at Charlie Trotter's. We will include birds that are roasted whole. We'll include pieces of meat, but
that's not in the tasting, the vegetarian tasting.
But
menu.
even the grand tasting menu, it's entirely possible to have a meal where you just have a tiny piece of meat along the way, and you've got maybe fish and shellfish and vegetable dishes that are part of that menu as well. So,
And you also for a while had a raw menu. That has to create even greater challenges.
Well, we've had a raw menu now in place for about 4.5-5 years. I wrote a book called Raw with a great friend, colleague, Roxanne Klein from the Bay Area in San Francisco. And it's one more way to explore vegetable vegetarian cooking. And it has nothing to do with a political approach or any kind of agenda. It's about celebrating flavor.
So are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm far from a vegetarian. I eat all kinds of things, and I eat everything every day. The Kleins, Michael, Roxanne, would come in and visit me. I've known them for 14, 15 years, and they had long been vegans, and about 5, 6 years ago, they began to challenge me to prepare raw vegetable preparations, and I kind of fell in love with the idea, but again, from an aesthetic standpoint, flavor standpoint, and we wrote the book then.
A caller wants a definition of degustación. I thought we kind of provided it along the way, but can you explain?
Well, I think of it as a tasting. It's a way to put together a series of things, and it's not so simple as just here are my greatest hits or here are some ideas. It's almost like a musical composition. Each dish needs to make sense vis-a-vis the preceding dish, the subsequent dishes, to add up to something that is greater than the sum of the parts.
So it's like putting together a CD where you want one track to follow another one because it furthers things along.
Sure. And it's easy just to say, here's this luxury item, here's this luxury item. It's much more interesting when everything makes sense and there's a flow to it.
Well, most of those tasting menus start off with the light thing and then go to the heavy thing. I spoke to a chef recently who said it should be the other way around because by the time those big meat dishes come out near the end, you already feel like you've had enough.
Well, I couldn't more profoundly disagree with that assessment. But you're building, it's not like you have to serve more food or bigger things, but if you're thinking of it also simultaneously in terms of a wine progression, wines would need to build in the same way.
You're listening to an interview from 2004 with the late chef Charlie Trotter. He was here to talk about his book and PBS series called Workin', More Kitchen Sessions with Charlie Trotter. And we'll be back with more about conversation, including a discussion of the work that Charlie Trotter did with Chicago high school students right after this break. We're back with a conversation I had in 2004 with Chef Charlie Trotter, who died earlier this month at the age of 54. He was here to talk about his PBS series and cookbook, both of which were called Workin', More Kitchen Sessions with Charlie Trotter. We are airing it again as part of today's special edition of Food Fridays. And I opened the second part of our conversation by asking about how closely linked the series and the book were.
It profiles the preparations that you see on the show, but it's very much meant to be an independent, standalone book. If you never watch the show, you don't even have to be aware of it. The book can serve you well.
And it also has a lot of wonderful photographs. Often that's a problem. You get a recipe that sounds really terrific, and then you have no idea what it's supposed to look like, or you get a drawing that really doesn't give you any indication. But this must be very expensive to put together all these color photographs and then black and whites of preparation as well.
I would never say that we make a lot of money on these books, but I've always considered the close-up, very tight image of the food, which, by the way, is unstyled and undoctored and unmanicured, to be one component of the recipe. And as someone that might look at a recipe myself, I'd rather just see the name of the dish and the image and a couple of the key elements that are in the dish. I don't need to see all these steps. I think a lot of people think that way, too. If they're cooking at home, oh, gosh, look at this. Well, I'm going to give this my own twist, and I see what they're doing here, but... And that's one of the reasons that we emphasize the photography like we do.
I mentioned earlier that someone called in and said he feels intimidated going into fine restaurants. Is he going into the wrong fine restaurants, you think?
No, he's not, and he shouldn't. And I myself grew up in a family where food and fine dining and restaurants were absolutely not part of our upbringing. And I finally went to my first big special dinner when I was 17, my junior prom, something like that, senior prom, whatever that was. And it wasn't until 4 years later that I went to another fancy restaurant, the great Le Francais. This was back in the early 80s.
Considered one of the great restaurants of the world
of its day. Yeah, oh, absolutely. And, you know, I look at my own parents. I've taken them out enough now, and my father's deceased now, but back then, and they didn't know what was up, and I never wanted them to feel intimidated. And so I think the best fine dining restaurants don't. You've got all different types of people. You've got extremely sophisticated people, and they travel to Europe on vacations. They go to Japan. They're friends with winemakers. They're friends with the great chefs. And at the very next table, you got these two people are celebrating their 25th wedding anniversary, and they don't know all the details, and you got to make them feel comfortable.
And the best restaurants don't come across as snooty.
No, I don't believe so.
But do you like the other kinds? Do you go to barbecue pits? Do you?
Well, one of the reasons I'm in this business is I'm not just a cook or an operator of a restaurant. I'm a fan, and I like all different types of dining experiences. And I enjoy being on the other side. I enjoy sitting at the table, and going to little ethnic storefront restaurants and casual restaurants. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So a roadside oyster stew is
love it.
Is something you would eat?
Absolutely, I love it.
You have a restaurant that's going to be opening here at the Time Warner Complex in Columbus Circle. It wasn't it already scheduled to be open? What's happening?
Oh, no. We didn't even sign our arrangement to be involved until last spring. And we're in no hurry. I just opened a restaurant in Mexico not even quite a year ago. And
where, in Mexico City?
Down in Los Cabos. It's a really lovely spot. And I'm down there about every 10 weeks. So. For me, it's not about expansionism, and this is a great opportunity to work with some of my esteemed colleagues and friends, and you know, it'll happen when it does, and we're targeting an August opening.
So. How is it possible to keep your standards up in the Chicago restaurant and then in Los Cabos and then one here? I mean, I've always wondered about that with all of the chefs who are now all over the world.
Well, I've been doing this now with Charlie Trotter's just about 18 years, and it's not like I've got 15 restaurants, and I deal with an issue that I know that a lot of my colleagues deal with. You've got amazing people that are working for you. You draw from the very cream of the crop. And in some cases, I've got people that have been with me 12, 14, 15 years. And if you don't do something with these folks, then they're either going to go on their own or they're going to be hired by somebody else. So you need to find a way for them to grow.
Will the restaurant in New York be similar to the one in Chicago?
No. The Charlie Trotter's in Chicago is a very serious fine dining experience. And it's, for a lot of people, it's a big event. And, they're committing to 3 to 4 hours at the table and, well, frankly, a huge expenditure. And that's all I've done now for almost 18 years, this big production. And it's fun for me, in a sense, to kind of let my hair down a little bit and do something that's fine dining, but not quite over the top like that.
Wouldn't it also have to change simply because the ingredients are different in different parts of the country? Are you relying mostly on local stuff?
Well, we use local product, but I've got 95 different purveyors that we're drawing from at any given time. Farmers, growers, fishermen, foragers of different sorts, dry goods purveyors.
People who actually grow stuff for you specifically.
In some cases, they do. And I share a number of purveyors with my colleagues. And, we live in a time where you can get something quicker flown in than you can get it, trucked down 5 hours from, north of where you live. So I can, We use all different types of things.
Now, you talked about growing up without a real experience of fine dining. One of our listeners is shocked, he says, that you have developed such a refined culinary sensibility under those circumstances. How did that develop?
Well, when I was in college, I had one roommate who used to cook, and I was fascinated by the process of rounding up ingredients from 5 different stores and making bread from scratch and making wine from scratch and pasta from scratch, and because I had never seen this before. So I became intrigued, and I used to cook with him, and then he'd cook one day, I'd cook the next day, and it turned into almost like a little competition who could make the more elaborate 4 or 5 course menu for dinner every night. So,
do you think of it as being the equivalent of being an artist, or is this more artisanal?
Well, I don't know.
Are you a craftsman, do you think?
There's a huge amount of craft that goes into it, and there's a huge amount of attention to detail. And in some cases with chefs, there's certainly an artistic element, and that means both in terms of the creativity of how dishes are conceived and also in terms of how food is delicately handled and put on the plate.
So. Don't you also have a program for high school kids in Chicago?
We do. We have something that we call the Excellence Program, and it's 5.5 years now in place. And 2 and 3 nights a week, we welcome Chicago Public High School students to come and have a dining experience, and they have the same thing that we offer the regular guests, 8, 9, 10 courses. They hear from a dozen staff members, sous chef, pastry chef, sommelier, who talk about how they pursue excellence on a daily basis. And then each one of my staff members fields questions until everyone in the room is asked two questions. But it's not about recruiting young folks to the culinary world. It's more about showing them what this kind of work is about.
Actually giving them also an experience that you didn't have until you were much older, which
yes.
is a sense of what else is out there for them
sure.
rather than just McDonald's.
Yeah, well, in a sense of what teamwork is about and working with humility is about, and the idea that it doesn't matter what you want to do, deliver mail, paint houses, go to business school, you get what you give. And if you want a lot, you need to give a lot.
Do you know about Alice Waters? A program in Berkeley lunch is being given as a course?
I know it very well, yep.
Do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's a great idea.
Why do you think that isn't happening more? Why do you think that America is developing a real gap between people who care about the ingredients that go into their food, really care about flavor, and people who just drop in at the local fast food place and eat something that usually isn't all that healthy for them?
Well, part of it is the culture, and we're a culture of convenience, and we're a culture that's on the go, and we're more and more removed from family meals and things cooked from scratch, and it's convenient to stop and get this thing quickly. And Alice is the pioneer of saying, wait a minute, slow down, let's go back to how things are grown and prepared with love. And if you nurture the spirit and the soul, you'll in turn nurture the mind.
Well, what happens when those kids come to the restaurant and say, ugh, what's this? I won't eat it, especially the vegetables.
Well, we ask if anybody has any aversions or dislikes or allergies, and we adjust things accordingly. But on the other hand, we ask for an open-mindedness. And it's great when young people are being served sea urchin or sweetbread or rabbit kidneys for the first time. Some young men and women poke them around on the plate, move them around. Others take a chance, and they eat those things. And it's a gratifying thing to see at 7 o'clock, 7:30 at night, when that school bus is pulling back up in front, vying for space with stretch limousines and luxury automobiles, people getting out saying, here are the students. Are we in the right place? I thought this was this very expensive high-end restaurant. What are these students doing here? What's the school bus doing here? So
let them know that they're not the only ones who can eat a decent meal. Talk to me a bit about the TV series. You are all over the place with this. You don't want us to just have a sense of a restaurant turning out fancy recipes that sometimes we can duplicate at home.
Well, our PBS series, The Kitchen Sessions, this is its third season of 26 episodes, and we about every other year we'll take 2 weeks and do these shows. They're filmed at the restaurant, in our kitchen, in our dining room, in our studio kitchen. It's unscripted, it's improvisational. It's meant to show the intensity of the work environment and what happens in the restaurant kitchen of a four-star restaurant, but then it's sort of brought and made accessible for the home cook, deconstructed in a sense, and we sort of break it down. And I don't consider myself a TV personality, a TV chef personality, but I have no problem doing what we do and exposing it. I think people are intrigued by what happens, and then we make it accessible.
There are some people who feel that this whole idea of duplicating a dish that you had in a restaurant at home is kind of silly, that home cooking should be home cooking and restaurant food, which is made with different kinds of machinery and techniques, should be restaurant cooking. Well, you probably have 10 people working on some dishes.
We have a lot of people. I've got 25 people that work in my kitchen during service. But I'm not saying that one would have to duplicate each of these dishes exactly. And that's why, for example, if the dish being featured has pigeon breast and black trumpet mushrooms and this sweet corn emulsion and these little elements, when we're doing the version in the studio kitchen for the home cook, it's chicken breast and it's button mushrooms and it's sweet corn vinaigrette. And it's taking an idea that exists in this rarefied environment and it's making it very much approachable for the home cook.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I can't wait for the restaurant to open. When is it opening?
We're opening, soft opening in August, early August of 2005.
So. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, we
maybe I'll just have to move to New York just to, you know.
Well, you're going to be here for a while, I hope.
Oh, I'm going to be here
for the restaurant opens.
Long time, yeah.
We hope you've enjoyed this conversation with the late Charlie Trotter. For more tips, recipes, and conversations about food, visit us at WNYC.org/Food Fridays. And tune into next week's Food Friday show when Roseanne Gold will announce the winners of our three-ingredient recipe challenge. On Monday's show, Nicholas Davidoff describes spending a year with the New York Jets. Given full access, he sat in on preseason training, early morning quarterback meetings, and late-night strategy sessions. Then soprano Martina Serafin, I'm playing the role of the Marshalin in Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier at the Metropolitan Opera, we'll take a look at Russia's furthest outposts in the early 19th century, which were in California and Hawaii, and part of a grand vision of one of Russia's most eccentric characters, plus details about the surprising instances of child labor in tobacco fields here in America. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Nishik, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. And I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you on Monday.